Welcome to the podcast channel of the Ghent Institute for Classical Studies. For the first episode of this second series, Classicists on the Move, in which we look at the important aspect of mobility in the academic world. For this first episode, we invited Andy Hirkens, an ancient historian trained at Ghent who recently moved to Oxford University. We are Dimitri and Pyrrhal, and we hope you enjoyed the conversation. So welcome to the second series of the Geeks podcast. This time it's called Classicists on the Move, travel stories from within Ghent University's classics community. And today for our first episode, we have Andy Hirkens. Now, Andy is a kind of peculiar scholar. So I'll let him explain himself what kind of a scholar he is, Andy.
Thank you very much. First of all, thank you for inviting me here. It's a pleasure to be here. Well, you asked me, I should define myself. This is already a very tricky thing. I would say maybe, put it very, very briefly, philologist and maybe cultural historian of Christians and Christianity in the pre-modern Middle East and the Caucasus, which is basically, you know, I'm going to say, I focus mostly on Syriac and Armenian Christianity, but I also dabble in like Byzantine studies, late antiquity, Middle Ages, Christian Arabic studies, and sometimes even Latin if necessary. So I focus lots of different projects, but my main project focuses on interaction between Syriac and Armenian Christianity, specifically in the 11th and 12th centuries. And I study it through the lens of a bishop called John Byron Reyes, a Syriac Orthodox bishop, who wrote a treatise against the Armenians, and is also one of very few people from that period who we know was bilingual, Syriac and Armenian. And so through his works, I tried to figure out how bilingual he actually was and how this informed his anti-Armenian writing. And he's also the author of the only known Syriac translation of an Armenian text, which is a polemical treatise from the 11th century, so several years before him. And so he's also the author of this translation. And so I tried to figure out from studying this translation how bilingual he actually was, and if the sources say that he was bilingual, but if this is actually the case, and how his works are informed by his bilingualism. And this is part of a larger project of mine, in which I focus on interaction between Syriac and Armenian Christians and Christianity. So not only in the 11th and 12th centuries, but also earlier and later, which is why I say pre-modern Middle East, because it's not just limited to late antiquity and the Middle Ages. Because, for example, we work, as Syriacists and Armenologists, we work very often with a much later manuscript from the Ottoman period. So we sometimes just have to, let's call it be flexible. Let's put it that way.
Well, that sounds absolutely fascinating, Andy. Before we move on to your travel stories, because you have some interesting stuff to say about the aspect of mobility in our classics community, when you're talking about your research, because it makes me curious, it covers a lot of ground, and you seem to me a very holistic scholar. So I'm immediately wondering, is this something you're passionate about, in the sense of combining a lot of different kind of periods, stuff, sources into your research? Are you someone who's constantly looking for like new stuff to include in his work? You don't seem to me someone who is constantly doing the same thing.
I don't necessarily look for it. I think I just stumble upon these things. Some would say probably my interest might be a bit too broad, and I take up maybe a little bit too much work. So sometimes it's a bit difficult to kind of balance out what kind of projects to take on and which ones to just leave. But there are, I mean, in terms of interaction between these different kind of Christian traditions, it's such a fascinating world and very, very understudied. There are, I would say, maybe a few hundred people actually work. Well, a few hundred people would actually work on this, but there's so many unpublished texts and so much literature still to study, which is traditions which have been studied since pre-modern period already, also in the West, but they're much less studied than, for instance, Greek or Latin literature. And so, but I try to I have sort of a very wide view in the things that I study. But this sort of, I think, also goes back to my own studies, because actually originally I started studying archaeology, which I kind of very quickly stopped because I noticed I was missing the languages. It was very exact sciences, mm-hmm. and it's mm-hmm. exact sciences are really not my thing. So I switched to Egyptology. So I'm actually originally trained as an Egyptologist and a Coptologist before I actually changed to Syriac and Armenian studies. So this is, I think this is where this already comes from. That I have a very wide range of interests in different traditions, but also in our field, the focus is tends to be very much on interaction between these Eastern Christian traditions and then either the Latin tradition or the Greek tradition, but less so in terms of these traditions amongst themselves. Certainly for Syriac and Armenian, some people have studied this, but very little. But also in terms of interaction between Egyptian or Syrian Christians, that kind of thing. It's even less studied than everything else. Mm. So there's a huge range of texts and authors still to study. So if anyone who's listening is interested in learning any of the languages and kind of getting involved, it's always a good thing. But it's a fascinating world and still very unknown.
Would you say that the fact that it was very understudied drew you to this field, or why did you choose this wide range of subjects, this family of subjects, actually?
I have no idea. I know when I was little, I was already interested in like ancient Egypt, that kind of thing, but also these types of texts like the Dead Sea Scrolls and the and these Nag Hammadi codices, that kind of thing. I was very much interested in this. Of course, at that point, I didn't have access to academic literature, and I was reading these rubbish books about like with these kind of conspiracy theories, because that's all there was in our public library. So that's at least that has changed. Let's be clear. But I think that's where it started. But why, I have no idea. So this is kind of still a continuing process.
Let's delve into your other adventures, connecting to research is mobility, because the theme of this podcast is classicists on the move. So if I'm not mistaken, you've been working at Ghent University since 2010, first as a PhD and then as a postdoc. But you're preparing actually for a big move. So why are you leaving us, Andy?
I'm leaving because I applied for the Newton International Fellowship at the University of Oxford, and in November, I got the news that I was actually awarded it, which came as a bit of a shock, because I really didn't expect that. So it's a great opportunity to spend 2 years at the Faculty of Oriental Studies in Oxford, where I actually already spent a year during my PhD. Mm-hmm. I had the pleasure of going there with a grant from the BOF Fund, mm-hmm. Special Research mm-hmm. Fund, and so I know already what a great place it is to actually work.
For people not familiar with this kind of scholarship, can you elaborate a little bit on what it is precisely that you got?
The Newton International Fellowship is a fellowship that is specifically, it's a postdoctoral fellowship mm-hmm. For researchers outside of the UK.
Okay.
And so you get funding for 2 years. You have to apply very specifically what you need money for and what purpose, and you have to apply with someone, a professor or researcher at a UK university, and with a very specific project as well.
A promoter, sort of, right?
I think that's the idea, but it's mentioned very specifically as a co-applicant, so it's not really, because it's very much the idea for this fellowship is very much on a project that benefits both the person coming and the person actually working together with the applicant as well. So it's very much also in the application itself, you really had to show how your project would benefit the person you would be working with, but also the university and the country itself.
This is quite a prestigious scholarship. Huh? Is it something like the Holy Grail?
I think it's about 40 people a year are actually awarded the fellowship. I think it's about 12 or 50, I can't remember the exact number in the humanities, so who are actually awarded this. So this is really why I didn't expect a positive result. but I'm glad I applied for sure, but maybe had I realized before how competitive it would have been, I might not have applied, but I think that's a very good lesson. I've been telling people since as well, saying like, even if it doesn't look like you might get it, just get an application, it's or you might, your application might be accepted, just try, you never know, it could be worth it. And for this application also, I reworked my FWO application, which was also successful, so that actually helped. I didn't have to, it took a while to prepare the application, but still. So if you have the opportunity to apply for these kind of things, I think you really should.
And what do you think made your application successful?
Good question. I don't really know. I suppose it might have stood out because not that many people work in our field, of course. Well, I don't know who the other applicants were or how many applied, so I don't know. What I think may have helped was that I tried very hard to explain not only what I was going to do there, but what my long-term plans were.
Mm-hmm.
So how would this benefit the years after that, and how does it fit into a longer career plan, but also in terms of future publications and another project application, because this is will also be part of an ERC application that I'm preparing as well. So kind of showing how everything is connected,
yeah.
But what,
yeah.
To what would come, but also what has come before.
Yeah, you're actually demonstrating that you're thinking much more also into the future, and like you're thinking ahead. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Not just these 2 years, and this
mm-hmm.
is what's happening these
mm-hmm.
2 years, but what's happening afterwards, what's happening before, and also in the years that are happening afterwards, how will those years reflect on the UK as well. All of that, how does everything contribute? How does it fit into a longer pattern?
How are the preparations going for your departure? Has this been postponed also by COVID-related events, or is this something that you were planning to do now, or is this something that is you've applied for it when, like last year or 2 years ago?
I can't remember exactly when the application went through. I think it was before the summer last year.
Okay.
And then I think I got the confirmation in November. So there was not really any,
okay.
COVID did not
okay.
affect it at all.
Okay.
No.
Are there other stuff at the moment that you're experiencing troubles with, in the sense of, is it going smoothly?
well, some problems with the visa, which is taking much longer than I expected, but I suppose that was to be expected as well.
Yeah.
So it might be a bit short notice. Because I'm supposed to be leaving I'm supposed to be starting on the 1st of May, so in less than 2 months, which is really, come to think of it, it's much quicker than I expected. It's really time's flying. It's really really difficult.
Now, this is not your first time you're going to Oxford, right? You have a relationship in your research with Oxford already, so it's like going back to the roots or something. Is it like revisiting also the institution for you?
Yeah, so I stayed there already a year during my PhD,
mm.
which I tell everyone was one of the best years of my PhD. Really, so much fun, just because of the people and but also because it's such a productive environment as well. Because they have seminars every day from various different
mm-hmm.
backgrounds, and you could just attend lectures every day continuously. But also just the faculty where I'd be working is like a fun place. It's also, you would meet in the morning for tea at 11 every day, and there would be people, like a different mix of people every morning, who are just talking about different kind of types of research with people. You would meet people from all over the world, because the people that are there would attract people from everywhere. So well, of course, lots of the people who I met there when I was there, it was already 9 years ago, a lot of the people will already have left. But Professor David Taylor, with whom I applied for this project, is still there. So I met him, of course, then. And so we have been keeping in contact. So this contact, so for sure, this would have contributed as well. So I can really, I think everyone who's doing a PhD, really, if you get the opportunity to go abroad for a year, you should just do it. It's just such a huge enrichment of your experience, even if you're not considering to do anything in academia afterwards. It's just,
yeah.
You spent a year abroad, just like different, you get different
yeah.
different experiences, meeting different people. It's very much something I would recommend.
It's like mobility attracts mobility afterwards, because your stay in Oxford led to your later stay in Oxford. That's going to happen soon.
Mm. Yeah. Well, I would say, I'm not sure if I might almost call it addictive. I don't know. Because I really try to spend as much time abroad as well as I can. Because this is my second FWO postdoc. I already spent a year in Jerusalem in between my first postdoc. So you can postpone the postdoc for a year. And so I spent 1 year in Jerusalem with a fellowship at the Hebrew University. And then with the senior research fellowship of the FWO, I postponed it for 1 year to work for a year in a project in Frankfurt, which because of COVID, I didn't move. So technically that isn't really a stay abroad, but we were having online meetings. So that was more or less a stay abroad, but it was a very strange experience in that sense. But
this is interesting, Oxford and Jerusalem. If you should compare the two in sense of the experience you had living abroad in Jerusalem or Oxford, how would you describe the difference between the two?
For one, at the Hebrew University, most classes are taught in Hebrew, which I don't speak, so that doesn't help. although I did attend one class that a friend of mine was teaching in English, but most of it is in Hebrew, comparing the two.
What was like a typical day in Oxford or a typical day in Jerusalem when you were there?
Well, in Oxford, I would just spend an entire day in the same library. Of the Faculty of Oriental Studies, or some days I would be in the Bodleian Library, for instance, checking manuscripts. But most of the time was spent in the same location. In Jerusalem, usually I would spend the mornings in the Ecole Biblique, which is an amazing library attached to some monastery of Saint Stephen. And in the afternoons, I had the pleasure of actually being allowed to work in the library of the Armenian monastery.
Mm. Was there any difference that you noticed in your relationship towards your colleagues or supervisors? I don't know. Do you see any significant difference in there in culture, like as Pyril said, like academic culture, like how supervisors or professors deal with postdoctoral colleagues, or wasn't there any particular different feeling on that?
I think as I said, in Oxford we meet like every day in the morning.
Mm.
But there was very much an opportunity to do that, maybe less so at the Hebrew University. But I was sharing an office with a colleague, so whenever, sometimes I also spent, this is something I forgot to mention, sometimes I also spent time at the office at the university campus, but it was quite far away from where I was living. I was living in the Old City, so I didn't spend that much time there. Also, very strange experience. Yeah, something very random is that actually, well, because of the situation, of course, in Jerusalem, you actually have to go through security as well to actually get into the university campus.
Maybe a kind of final question. You're obviously used to traveling and to going abroad and to being in different environments, but in the light of your departure for Oxford, is there one thing that you perhaps will miss about Ghent, and what are you looking forward to? If you're thinking about moving to Oxford, is there something that you're like, I am looking really forward to this aspect of my stay in Oxford, and this is something perhaps I will miss from Ghent?
Well, I made a lot of friends here and colleagues, and I most likely I will not come back as well, so that will be very strange. But I know, I know where I'm going to, and I really like Oxford. I really enjoy my stay there, so I'm really looking forward to that. I also, I don't want to promote veganism at this point, but there's an amazing vegetarian pub in Oxford. It's one of my favorite places. I always mention it when I talk about Oxford. So I'm really looking forward to being back there again.
What's the name?
It's the Gardener's Arms. It's out. In Jericho, I think. There's actually two Gardener's Arms. It's a very common name, I think. I don't know, but it's a lovely place. I really like it. I have vegan chili dogs. So I'm really looking forward to that. No, but also just the academic environment of Oxford, and just having access to so many so many people, so many seminars, and just it's going to be a bit overwhelming in the beginning, I think.
Thank you very much, Andy, for this talk on your upcoming departure for Oxford. We wish you a lot of luck, and hopefully you'll be back also one time in Ghent.